that note, do not say this to the cat. I knew you were getting ready to. No, that is not the note we are starting on, sir. Think of something else. Come up with something
else. This is InfoCast 5000.
Hey, everybody. It's Baron Malley, one of the hosts of this podcast.
And this is Sam Makeup, one of the other hosts of this podcast.
This is the podcast where we dive into the history of things familiar to everybody. Join us as we try to what, Sam?
Figure out why everything exists.
That's right. Welcome. You made it through part one. You are a trooper. We are talking about taxidermy again this week. One more time.
I feel like we didn't even get into it the way we thought we were going to get into it. But this week, we definitely are getting into it the way we thought we were going to get. We are so into it. We're in it like a bunch of dudes in a factory stuffing dead animals. Last week, we delved into the complicated and colorful past of the origins of taxidermy in ancient Egypt and the millions upon millions of mummified animals attributed to the world's first taxidermist. We tried to explain about the sudden decline in our obsession with preserving the dead following the Egyptians and why all of a sudden we became intrigued once again by nature again in the 16th century. And as our interest in nature was revived, so was our obsession with owning it, and that certainly included preserving the corpses of animals we felt were important enough to keep around. And now, on the precipice of what becomes known as the taxidermy boom, we're going to try and explain how it happened and where taxidermy went after that. So please join us today as we continue to try to figure out why taxidermy exists.
As we blaze forward in history through the 16th and 17th centuries, much of what taxidermy became was spurred on by wealthy individuals coveting exotic art, flora, and of course, fauna that eventually found its way into the first museums. We touched on this a bit in the first episode. At the same time, increased exploration had naturalists spanning the globe bringing back specimens to either be housed in collections for rich people to show off or to be studied.
So why did rich people in these centuries start to obsess over taxidermy? Well, some important context that we didn't get into in the first episode was America's fetishization of nature going all the way back to the founding of Jamestown in 1607. Of course, this is just us talking about the particularly American obsession with it, which if you do go back to Jamestown, you're kind of also talking about the English, and that could expand greater into the European interest in it as well, because they all kind of were like the same at that point. So until about the closing of the Western frontier in 1890, going back to America here, the encounter of white settlers with what they perceived as wilderness was the defining American experience. For one example of a way this fascination manifested was that there was an entire industry built around the interior, interior decorators in the 18th and 19th century to paint murals of wildlife in patrons' homes or incorporate taxidermized animals in and around cabinetry and other house fixtures. And this is something that we're going to save for Dirty Bits, but don't even get me started about the Victorian era, like Great Gatsby era of taxidermized animals on hats. Another important bit of context besides the aesthetic and the status-based fascination was how we as a intellectual society decided to document studied wildlife pre-taxidermy. And this is somewhat where we left off on part one a little bit and is going to be the underlying driving force behind the development of taxidermy from around the 18th century moving onward. But the answer to the question of how we documented and studied wildlife pre-taxidermy was illustrations. Illustrations were the standard of documenting and conveying the information you as an explorer used to share your discoveries and were then used as a reference for other professionals in the field for convenience because everyone couldn't be out on the field all the time conversing about nature. However, what is usually lost in those often, even as lavish as they are, illustrations is a certain truth about the way many naturalists were used to interacting with their objects of study, the animals, the flora, the fauna, if you will. So what is a way that you could preserve the likeness of a specimen with the detail of an intricate illustration while also tapping into the familiarity of observing said specimen in the wild in a real space? The answer to that is to bring that illustration into the three-dimensional world, aka taxidermized specimens. And these specimens were kept in civic and university buildings to house collections used for conducting research. However, These served more as storage spaces than museums by today's understanding. So there wasn't really still a accessible to the public way to kind of educate the people as a whole versus just keeping it as a niche kind of exhibit for professionals that already kind of had access to this information.
So you're saying people had taxidermy warehouses, just buildings.
I know where you're going, but they weren't really warehouses. They were, you know, by today's standards, they were probably closer to warehouses because this is this is pre-climate control, even drywall. So, you know, these were like brick and mortar buildings with just boxes, probably cedar boxes full of hay and dead animals. So yeah,
sounds like a party.
It was to some.
As a side note, though, on what you were saying, I just wanted to say, I thought it was really interesting, you know, being an illustrator and you're an artist yourself, how we had...
How dare these... you?
You're an artist?
How dare you?
I'm sorry. I'm calling it like it is, Sam.
Artist of truth.
You got... you got that degree. From a renowned art school.
We don't have to talk about that.
Anyway, what I thought was interesting about this was, you know, even if you go back to the Renaissance period, how somebody could be a scientist and a naturalist, but also an amazing illustrator. And I guess I'm kind of envious of both those skills a little bit. Because if you look at some of those old illustrators, especially since they didn't have cameras, they didn't really have reference, so they were drawing everything on the fly, you know?
You know what it is? They weren't in the rat race.
Well, yeah, they didn't have to, go to a 9-to-5 job to and pump out, you know, drawings.
And they didn't have to pick out what curtains best match the linoleum and their foyer, and they didn't have to mow their lawn, and I'm pulling all this out of my ass, but they did, like, life was different. It was, you know, they had less, sure. But they had what they were at an abundance of seemed to be time.
They definitely had the leisure time to study both. But I just, you know, it's interesting, and I value their multi-skilled abilities.
And as someone who studied traditional painting, I do have a bit of, you know, I could go on and on about the Renaissance men and, you know, that they believed that being proficient in all categories was to be like adequately using your time on earth wisely. So they were more driven by like faith and spirituality to be good at all those things, but whatever.
well, continue.
For some of them didn't believe in a God. They were the weirdos. So for many 18th and 19th century naturalists, biologists, zoologists, there were many animals that they didn't even encounter for the first time in the wild. Once this practice started beginning, like these private university collections of specimens, they were first encountered in the display case in the form of carefully preserved taxidermized corpses. But despite the renewed interest in the practice, the technology was still some ways off. But that didn't stop the industry from raking in cash from both these private collections of academia trying to get their collections off the ground and the eager eccentric trying to look for new home decor. Workshops that resembled assembly lines started popping up all over Europe and the Americas and churned out stuffed corpses with very little effort. And this only gets ramped up even more once natural history museums become a popular public attraction. The Natural History Museum did not exist as a typical museum prior to the 18th century, but by the mid-18th century, we saw an increased interest in the scientific world by the middle class who had at this time greater time for leisure activities, physical mobility, and educational opportunities than the previous eras. This was followed by other forms of science consumption, such as the zoo, that had already grown in popularity by this time.
And remember, they didn't have, you know, TV or movies at that time, so that was the thing to do. You know, that was the exciting thing to do, was let's go look at the weird Eastern flupa fauna at the Natural History Museum. Because we don't know what one looks like, and it was startling to see one at the time, you know? Through the amassing of these collections, natural history becomes this prominent mode of study, and that takes a huge upswing in the 18th century, and that brings taxidermy to the forefront as a legit scientific pursuit, as opposed to just a way to spook grandma on a Friday night for laughs. Museums begin to open, displaying taxidermied animals from strange and wondrous locales to the public and any scientist wishing to catch inspiration fever.
So, speaking of old taxidermy and museums, I found out that the dodo actually has a unique relationship with taxidermy and how we treated these specimens during this era, in that it fell victim to both our obsession of overindulging in nature and also failing to preserve it correctly. More so, I view the dodo's unfortunate tale as a time where we felt it was more important to own and display nature than to actually observe and nurture it. Kind of an ongoing thread complete, of humanity.
If that concept of humanity was some kind of spiritual avatar come into form, it would definitely be in the form of a dodo. Absolutely.
No, because the dodo, yeah, I don't know. Does it?
If we're going to embody
the totem of humanity completely, like, just, like, you know, butt-fucking nature, it would just be like this big ravenous bear just, like, forcing itself onto a dodo.
You're going to have to explain that one.
Several dodos. It just has them, like, I'm just describing weird dodo porn now.
Yeah.
I'll stop. I'll stop if you tell me to stop. Otherwise, I'll just keep going.
Well, I'm just trying to figure out where you're coming from. You know, how are you justifying? You know, what does the bear represent?
There's a lot of ways. I'm saying there's a lot of ways you can use a dodo in that way.
Well, they are stupid birds. They were
stupid.
They were stupid.
Stupid
birds.
Sexy. The best part is they're disposable. You know.
Also, if anybody can hear this, this is a message for help, and I'm trapped and alone in a room with this man.
The dodo, which Portuguese sailors discovered in 1507, was drove to extinction by 1681. So a little over 150 years after we discovered them, we wiped them off the face of the fucking planet. This is after we over-harvested destroyed their habitat, and this is a fun way that they probably, like, they knew they were getting rid of them the other ways. They didn't even know they were getting rid of them this way. They introduced too many new animals to their island that either ate their eggs or out-competed them for food. You know, like rats, we would bring rats on the ships unintentionally, but then, like, dogs, hogs, because we brought hogs everywhere because, I don't know if you know about this, but, like, wild boars,
they can live everywhere.
Yeah.
They're good livestock.
Yeah. Settlers and whatever, like conquistadors would just bring them and then release them in the wild. And then they have like a good source of food in the wild. And they just have, you know, they're like the perfect, not the perfect. They were easy to bring places, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah.
One of the things I read, because when I was a kid, I had this big, thick nature book that I used to pore through all the time because it had these great illustrations. I think it's what got me into drawing animals in general. And when I was a kid, I just used to read that all the time. There's a section on it about the dodo in there. And one of the passages that was written in there, because it was kind of an old school book from like the 80s when we still believed dinosaurs were lizards. And that
you realize
kind of
we make a podcast about stuff that goes back to like ancient Egypt. And you just said old school from the 80s.
Well, it was old school scientific.
Also, you were born in the 80s, so it's not that old school.
Right. Well, what I mean is like it was based off of old school scientific thoughts.
Like from the 70s?
But that's not the important part of this. The important part is that there was a passage in it that said, like, and the dodos just used to walk right up to the camps, so we might as well just have killed them. You know, they were so stupid. They just walked right into the camps.
I don't think the book said that.
Yeah.
I think the book didn't say. I think you wrote that in pencil in the margins. Most of what accounted for the over-harvesting was the demand for rare taxidermized animals from afar. And the dodo, which could only be found on the island of Mauritius in the Indian Ocean, certainly qualified as rare. But little care was taken both in ensuring the accuracy of the creature's likeness in taxidermized form and the actual maintenance of the specimens after we stuffed them. Basically, back to what I was saying about the importance of owning it versus like the care taken to of what you do after you own it. You know, it's just kind of like the end all be all is I own this. Look, this is a dodo.
I can do whatever I want.
I can do whatever I want with this stupid fucking thing.
It's my dodo.
I can
walk right into my camp.
This is my,
you can't do that.
My girlfriend now.
You will go to jail.
Doda.
I'm calling the police.
There's no laws on this ship. Sailor, I'll remind you of that. Lest I remind you what we do to the dodos around here.
And then the sailor strapped two dodos to his arms as flotation devices.
And tried to swim away. He tried to fight the captain with dodos, killing many dodos in the dodo fight because they started using dodos as cannonballs.
It's
obviously
amazing that they're not around anymore.
I don't know. we drove him extinct. We are getting so far off on the dodos.
We're having fun though.
We drove him extinct, and we did such a bad job preserving them that people were actually wrong about how they looked for hundreds of years after they went extinct because of how disfigured the taxidermized remains were. It wasn't until like more modern technology where we could reconstruct like their musculature from their bones or whatever. But also, there's also happens to be not even a single complete skeleton of them that remains. So I don't know how they did that. The most complete dodo skeleton is in like some, like British museum, and they've made up the rest out of clay. They also happen to be the only animal that we currently have no existing taxidermizations of. And that's basically because through a series of unfortunate mishaps, carelessness, and imprudence that we have lost, destroyed, or in one case, simply threw out every taxidermized specimen of the dodo we ever had.
Well, apparently they were all lumpy pieces of shit anyway, so, you know, I don't think we were losing a lot there in terms of scientific pursuit. That's just...
Jesus, man, that's dark.
You said it. You said it. They were stuffing these things with sawdust and rags. They were just...
Oh, I thought you meant like the birds. Like, I thought you were saying like good riddance to an entire species of animal because they were dumb little shit fucks that you could kick around.
Look, I'm not the animal book that I read, that I used to read from the 80s.
You mean the book that you co-authored with crayon.
Anyway, so it's kind of funny this began... You know, this taxidermy thing, it began as this method of study, or at the very least, some anecdotal brandishing by rich people, and it turned into this ravenous coveting.
You mean like this era of taxidermy?
Right.
I just wanted to correct you. You said taxidermy, but you meant like this era.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. The resurgence in the 16th and 17th.
Right, yeah. Right, yeah.
Where
yeah,
like
exactly.
We mix science with like a natural fascination of nature.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That just turned into like, I have to... kill
own everything and kill all the birds, and we'll get into in a second about just how much we ramped it up, like Egyptian levels of murder.
Yeah and just to exemplify that, or just to put a exclamation point on that, one of the things that I read in the research said that basically naturalist study at this point in time was to shoot the animal, collect the corpse, taxidermy it, and then I guess make up whatever behavior you wanted at that point. I don't think they studied the animals too closely before shooting them.
No one was watching the dodos, but they just went in there like, God. Oh my God! Bang, 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 bang. Yeah, there are tons of early accounts of taxidermists receiving little more than the preserved hides and bones of an animal and nothing else. So it was on them to guess what the animal actually looked like, because it's not like they would get like any kind of illustrations from the hunters, or, you know, if you were in a sweatshop supposed to churn out, like, you had a quota, you had to churn out like 10 taxidermized things a week, and you've never even seen a fucking tiger in real life, you're just guessing what a tiger looks like.
Some people like jigsaw puzzles, eh?
Some people like a challenge, is what I'm hearing. And here at Malley & Co. Taxidermy, you know what? We like to think ourselves as kind of the Mr. Potato Head of taxidermy, you know?
Maybe dodos had a foot coming out of their mouths.
You motherfucker. You're hired. You just got promoted, actually. So somewhere between the 18th and 19th century, taxidermy grew out of its awkward adolescence phase and began being taken a little more seriously. There was a growing appreciation for taxidermy in a way to observe these objects for educational value or mental stimulation through the channels like those natural history museums we were talking about, as opposed to them being a source of prestige or oddities to gawk at or trophies to lord over your peers. Obviously, we've been kind of leading up into where this was kind of getting its start in places like private you know, institutions, these early or like private collections of institutions for naturalists and biologists, or like the earlier natural history museums that kind of started in the very early 17th century. You know, it starts to get a foothold in the Victorian era, and it starts becoming the driving force to where taxonomy goes. And from all the accounts that I could find, it looked like this all kind of came to a head as becoming the new gold standard at London's Great Exhibition of 1851, when specimens came to be judged on their lifelike manner. At the Great Exhibition, a motley assortment of creatures were transported across land and sea. It sparked an exhibition craze and promoted a global trade network, supplying a diverse array of events with multifarious items for display. Animals arrived in Britain in various states, both dead and alive and whole and incomplete. Whole animals and skins could be deposited in large barrels of pickle, ready to be mounted and remade into animal shapes by taxidermy firms in London and other British cities. Alternatively, skins could be covered in alum salt or a healthy coating of arsenic soap in the case of birds to dry them out and prevent rotting on long voyages. This kind of expansive network and sharing of knowledge and technique was a far cry from what was considered the cutting edge of taxidermy in the 18th century, where we had abortions of specimens like the taxidermized lion of King Frederick of Sweden, which was haphazardly stuffed with cotton and hay, had square wooden teeth mounted in its head, and whose eyes were literally another eye's length apart in the center of its forehead, because the taxidermist tasked with stuffing the lion had no information on what lions look like from the front. It's believed that he only had an illustration of a lion from the side, and being from Sweden, he's never seen a lion, so he just kind of winged it.
Sam, I think you're forgetting the most important part.
Mm-hmm.
The lion had its tongue sticking out.
Oh, so you did see a picture.
I sent you the picture.
Oh, well, shit.
Yeah, we had a whole conversation about it.
Yeah, it's awful. And that tongue looks gnarly, dude.
He has like this venom tongue.
Yeah, it's like a venom tongue. And it's like, well, I guess it wasn't cracking in the beginning, or maybe it was, but it's like cracking, and the eyes are just like, they look like the Coraline sewed on buttons.
But so, in, not in his defense, but if you look at like medieval illustrations of lions, you know, that's what a lion freaking looked like. That's what they thought a lion looked like.
Yeah, it sounds like you're defending him.
I guess I am.
But what cracks me up, though, is... So he was gifted that lion, and I had from where in my notes, but I kind of lost it. The lion didn't arrive dead. It was King Frederick's pet lion for years. So they knew what a lion looked like.
They knew what it looked like.
Didn't care. This guy came back with like Gumbo the lion, and King Frederick was like, well, close enough.
Well, so I think that's a great segue into what we're about to talk about, which is the conceptualization of animals beyond what they would normally be doing in nature. And so if we're talking about things like the exhibition in 1851, which garners the interest of showmen, like pre-vaudeville showmen, like P.T. Barnum,
mm-hmm.
for instance, who had his own taxidermy proclivities of his own, we might talk about at some point, maybe in the dirty bits. This bridges the gap between taxidermy for education and taxidermy for entertainment. And I would argue that the lion was more for entertainment rather than education.
I don't know. I think it was a shock preservation of prestige, though.
Well, that too. But that's entertainment.
That's entertainment, baby.
Well, I mean, it kind of is.
Yeah, it's status. It was like a lion that was gifted because he's king, and then it became his favorite lion. I think there was like nostalgia and sentimentality to it. I don't mean to be contrary, and I agree with your sentiment, but I don't think that was a good example of it.
Oh, okay. Well, I guess I just lump all of that stuff into anything that's not being learned from is entertainment. It's something else. So
anything that... So in your eyes, anything that isn't educational is fun. Which implies that anything that isn't fun is educational.
I'm not going to, you know, I want to detract on that statement, but I'm not going to. I'm just going to stand on my hill here.
You run with that any way you want, but you actively participate in an educational podcast that is educational.
Yeah.
Which you just separated from being in the category of fun.
You could have used anything else. You could have used murder.
As being fun?
No, as being, yeah, well, as
technically to you it is.
Well, okay, there you go. See, I just gave you ammo, I guess, but
yeah, you did.
Anyway, I'm gonna stand up on my hill here and say the rest of what I gotta say.
Oh, Gumbo the Clown! My existence is an abomination, and you think I'm fine.
Sorry, Gumbo. But so we have this setting, though, just to put us back to where we need to be. There was this exhibition in 1851 that happened, and now not only would a specimen be displayed in a museum for study, it might go on the road for one of these exhibitions. If you're not careful, P.T. Barnum might steal it out from your train, whatever.
I also think he comes a little later in history, right? P.T. Barnum?
No, he was around in the mid-1850s.
Really?
Mid-1800s, yeah.
Okay.
Right. Yeah.
He had a long career then, because he pops up in like turn of the century a little bit, like just on the cusp.
I guess so. Yeah, a little
like
bit.
1890s,
I think he died
a
little bit? In 1909.
Oh wow! Yeah. So he was like running it till the wheels fell off, huh?
Wouldn't you?
Would you? Yeah.
Or else you're gonna get turned into fucking exhibit. You
I
want to
cover.
Yeah.
I want to cover topics that overlap with P.T. Barnum more.
We're going to talk about him, I think. He's going to pop up again. This was a melting pot of collaboration and creativity in the taxidermy community. And this leads to a period in the taxidermy timeline I would like to call what in the flippity flam flow fuck were the Victorians doing?
Just
because...
That was beautiful. Yeah, and I know what you're getting at, but yeah, so right now the Victorians not only wanted their animals to look real... but they also wanted them preserved doing human activities, or in other terms, they wanted their taxidermy anthropomorphized. This kind of freedom came about once you got to learn the rules to break them. So we started kind of persevering to have more realistic taxidermy. And once we kind of hit a plateau of that for a little while, people thought, you know what? I think I want them playing golf.
Yeah.
I think I want him in the middle of a domestic dispute scene in a shitty studio apartment.
As the police break in. That's super whimsical.
Which is very close to an actual vignette that I'm going to get into. This style is also affectionately called as the Victorian whimsy era. If you wanted to Google it, it's totally worth a Google. This is also when the work of noted taxidermist Walter Porter, here's our first name, I think, right?
Yeah, Walter Potter.
Porter. Taxidermist Walter Potter gained popularity. He would arrange animals in a tableau depicting things like gerbils playing croquet, rabbits yawning through school lessons, or, and this is the one I was kind of referencing, dens and a rat being raided by local police rats. I looked at it. It's kind of hard to tell what they were getting busted for, but I like to think it was like a...
Rats would never be the popo.
Well, yeah, they would, because they're rats. He left school fairly young, at the age of 12, I believe, and his first attempt at taxidermy was his own pet canary, which he murdered to stuff. No, I'm kidding. It died of natural causes, and he was like, P.T., I'm going to bring you back to life, and then mommy will have to love me. P.T., that's a good bird. Potter's attention to detail in these scenes could be noted in one of his most famous depictions of a wedding of kittens, which means he had a bunch of dead kittens, to the extent that even the kittens were wearing frilly knickers under their formal attire. So don't let it fool you. This 12-year-old was collecting dead animals in his parents' basement because he practiced in the dusty old basement of their flat. Yeah, this 12-year-old handled tons of poisonous and mind-rotting chemicals and made very fun and fanciful dead animal vignettes.
Listen, man.
Nothing wrong with that.
No, okay.
He was probably the most popular kid in school.
Okay. My whole problem with this whole thing is...
Oh, you only have one.
Filthy knickers. Did he have to give them filthy underwear?
Frilly.
Did he?
I said frilly.
Oh, frilly. I thought that said filthy.
Well...
not that I, you know.
So you're okay with him having like 12 dead kittens, stuffing,
well, that's
stuffing them,
thing.
Dipping them in arsenic and strychnine.
I'm just trying
posing
to
them in a kid.
Issue.
Let me finish. Posing them in a fake kitten wedding, You have to gut them to stuff them. So he's gutting kittens. Let's take it back there. Gutting kittens in his parents' basement at age 12, covering them with strychnine and arsenic. That's okay. Well, but the thought of him putting less than clean underwear on them just was too fucking far.
I just have to deal with one issue at a time. Like the It Clown composing dead animals into these weird anthropomorphized scenes, I can deal with mentally, but the extra add-on of the filthy underwear on top of it is... It breaks my mind. Like, why would you make that decision? What went wrong in your life to choose it? Because then you're talking about, like, there's a sexual fetishization there. I don't know. But
I'm gonna.
But they weren't filthy. They were frilly. Yeah, so that's fine. Everything's fine.
I'm gonna go out on a limb and say that his sexual predilections extended far beyond dirty underwear, Aaron.
I'm cool with everything. I get it now. Frilly underwear is cool.
He would have loved the dodo boat.
I'm wearing frilly underwear right now. It was fine. So it was this Walter Potter character and a handful of early Victorian taxidermists that heralded this shift in context beyond a purely scientific pursuit. This was not an abrupt rift between the science and art community, but rather this two-headed monster that was fed by these jack-of-all-trades naturalists who started to get creative with the wildlife. As she grieves for Prince Albert, Queen Victoria set stylistic rules when it came to the ritual of mourning a loved one, and these rules became fad, and that fad becomes culture. As the everyday Victorian finds himself surrounded by diseases like typhoid and tuberculosis, as the Civil War rages in America, as workers die on a daily basis in the factories, death becomes a looming, pervasive shadow over the populace.
But are you describing now?
We're going to talk about that a little bit, actually, in terms of, like, what are the parallels between now and the Victorian? But that's going to have to wait till we set the stage
and
for what's going on.
In the 1880s in Victorian England?
A little bit.
All right.
A little bit.
I'm here for it, buddy.
But the embracing of death as a constant also leads to this playful familiarity and the artistic exploration of the concept thereof. This exploration can be seen in things like the photographing of dead people, which was huge at the time and incredibly unsettling, but also taxidermy adjacent in the way they were displayed as if they were still alive. If you want to see something that might ruin your day, go and Google Victorian dead people photographs. It's fucking weird. So you had all these gothy ghoul people running around, along with these exhibitions and museums booming, and this was the perfect storm for a taxidermy heyday. And that leads us to Beatrix Potter, who was a woman born in July 1966, and I'm sure...
1866.
Or 1866, who, and I'm sure we've all heard in passing as the woman who authored The Tales of Peter Rabbit, but she was also a naturalist and quite the creative taxidermist who would create these tableaus with the animals doing human things, like going to school or playing saxophone, like her contemporary Walter Potter, who was not related.
Yeah, we all know the story of the woman that authored Peter Rabbit was also drying the skin of multiple Peter Rabbits in her backyard and
I
posing
would say
the corpses of Peter Rabbits doing various tasks around her house.
Hey, we could say, you know, without her interest in taxidermy, would we have Peter Rabbit? Which I don't even know the story of.
We could do.
Is that the rabbit that gets caught in the garden and then taxidermied? I'm serious. There's like something bad happens to him. He gets caught in the garden of the farmer, and then he gets like something bad happens to him.
He gets like tortured for 6 days and.
It's like the first Saw movie.
The last chapter, I think it's like it's a volume. It's like a 4-book series, and by the last one, he's just kind of like begging for death. The last chapter is Peter Cottontail tries to bite his own tongue and choke on his blood.
Wait, what's that? What are those movies called that are like it's like BDSM porn for Harry Potter fans?
Where did you just go?
No, It's by the woman who sorry.
I like this episode a lot so far. This is fun.
The woman who wrote the Harry Potter BDSM fan fiction, and that got turned into a series of movies based off of BDSM.
I have no fucking clue what you're talking about.
It's super famous.
Why would you think I just like knew that?
It's super famous. Everybody fucking knows it. I just can't, like, I can't, never mind. Well, I was going to make a Peter Rabbit joke off of the name of that.
Is Hagrid in it?
No.
That's, no, that's a bummer. That's a bummer.
It doesn't have the actual Harry Potter characters in it, but it's going to bug me. Anyway, we could continue with the podcast now, I guess.
Are you talking about 50 Shades of Grey?
Yes. 50 Shades of Peter Rabbit. That's my joke. Thank you, everybody. Good night.
We got there. We got there, everybody. Feel silly continuing now. Hey, so this is running a little long.
What time are we at? Me?
You? Yeah, you're the one. You're the guy with the clock and all the recording equipment. Again. No.
I just got confused for a minute.
Yeah. Well, it's not. This wasn't the first time. But yeah. So what?
We are definitely running a little bit long here. I think this is a great spot to stop, though. I know we said we were gonna do two parts of this, but it looks like we're gonna do a third. Taxidermy.
So yeah, we did talk, you know, the script's a little long. We kind of belabored some of these topics, and we talked before the recording a little bit about how we're both not going to be able to record on Easter because of, you know, various obligations. And so if we did end up having to split this up, then we can give you an extra episode on Easter that you wouldn't have otherwise had. So that's what we're going to do, it looks like.
So where can you find us on the social media?
On the social media? Yeah. We're InfoGas5000 on Instagram. We've been getting more followers, more engagement. We love it. Please, if you like this episode, if you like what we do, if you like us, or even if you just like one of us, tell your friends. Tell one friend. Start with one friend. Don't tell all your friends. Tell one friend, and if they like it, then tell the other friends. But we don't want you to end up with no friends.
And if you're sitting in a dark room alone, drinking a beer, thinking about all the things that you've done in your life, one of those things should be going to the App Store if you're listening on iTunes and giving us a little rating. That would help us get some listeners in.
Yeah, it could be like the one nice thing you do today.
Or the bean thing if you leave us a bad rating.
Don't do but that don't, one. Don't leave that. Us a don't bad rating. That. Yeah.
I guess
pretty close to being that guy. We're one person away each from being that guy.
Yeah.
So don't joke.
I'm already there.
As you
there.
Said that, I was like taking a pull of my beer and I was like,
I'm already there. and also, if you have some weird taxidermy you want to share with me, send it over to infocast5000@gmail.com. I love looking at taxidermy photos. I am a avid follower of the taxidermy community. So
you
hit me up.
You invite the weirdest things into your life.
And you know, look at the product that it has produced.
That was
like Jesus rising from the grave. Here I am.
You're definitely more of an Easter bunny than a Jesus.
All right, everybody, that's it. See you next week.
That's it.
Bye.
Bye.